Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. Our guest today is Ellen Bialystok. Ellen is a Canadian psychologist and professor. She carries the rank of Distinguished Research Professor at York University in Toronto, and she's one of the world-leading experts on bilingualism, and this will be the topic of our conversation today. Hello, Ellen. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Hello. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, maybe we could start, Ellen, by you perhaps telling us a bit about your background and how you got involved in this field of work.
Sure. I started as a graduate student many decades ago, interested in child development. And I was especially interested in language and cognitive development in young children. So I studied how children's acquisition of language was a kind of a signal for them to acquire concepts.
Yeah.
What became clear, almost by accident, was that children who were learning more than one language were somehow going on this journey in a slightly different way. Now, in the 1970s, early to mid-1970s, there was some interest in something we call metalinguistic awareness, that is, understanding what language is, understanding that language has structure, that it's made up of words, that words are made up of sounds, and so on. And the reason this is an important topic is because it's essential for children to learn how to read. They need to come to understand those structural features of language to learn to read. So research in the 1970s was showing that children who knew two languages were getting these ideas earlier. They were more precocious. So potentially that was important. So for about 10 years, I studied the development of these metalinguistic ideas in monolingual and bilingual children. But I think what really turned it around was when we moved away from language with this bolder question, is something else different too? If they're getting these ideas about language earlier, these metalinguistic ideas, is there something different about their cognitive development? And it wasn't until really the late 1980s that we started looking at that question. So it followed from this earlier work. It was rooted in an interest that I always had in cognitive development, but it was also motivated by the prevailing view, not only in the academic literature, but in the general public, that surely learning two languages was very confusing for children.
Okay, now fascinating. Well, how tricky is it trying to measure bilingualism, and how would you define it?
It's extremely tricky because it's not like everything else we measure in research. We can divide our sample into girls and boys, and we're pretty sure who belongs where. We divide our sample into 7-year-olds and 9-year-olds, and we're pretty sure who belongs where. But monolingual and bilingual are not categories, they're a continuum. So we have to be very careful about what information we use to decide the level of bilingualism, the degree of bilingualism, the degree of monolingualism of individuals who participate in our studies. It's a continuum. So in some of our studies where we're conducting research, for example, with young adults, we have a rather practical criterion. We say these would be, you know, students who are sort of 20 years old and they're at university, so they're all studying in English. And the main criterion for being bilingual is, what do you speak at home? What language do you speak to your parents? What was your language of home?
Yeah.
And for a great many students, it's not English. And we can be sure that they are bilingual because they have a language of the home and a language of school. That's a relatively clear case. In other studies, it's more important to measure the degree. So we actually scale how bilingual or how monolingual individuals are, And instead of using categories, we use those descriptions.
Okay, so could I ask you to unpack a bit more, Ellen, the main ways that your research indicates that bilingualism is helpful and advantageous?
We've done research across the entire lifespan. We've looked at children, young adults, older adults, and we find two general patterns. The first thing we find is that if you measure simple language ability in one language, and the language we measure is English, then on average, bilinguals have a smaller vocabulary, more effortful access to words, that is, they're slower to retrieve names of pictures. So just using one of the languages for a bilingual is more effortful and somewhat diminished compared to a monolingual speaker of only that language. In contrast, if we give these groups tasks that ask them to rapidly select the right answer when there is a very compelling distraction, a misleading alternative that you have to ignore, bilinguals are better. I can give you an example of a task in psychology that's used all the time. It's called the Stroop task. And you're told, I'm going to show you words. Don't read the word. Just name the color of the ink. And what you actually end up seeing is color names like blue, red, green, printed in different colored ink. So the word blue could be printed in red. What you have to say is red. Don't read the word. You have to say red. It's extremely hard to do because you have to ignore and not attend to this very salient information, which is the word. That's the sort of things bilinguals do better.
Okay, so in a sense, they are less prone to be distracted.
Yes.
Are they also, your research also shows they're better at filtering out irrelevant information as well?
Yeah, that's the same, that's the other side of the same coin. So what I prefer to think about it as is they're better at selectively attending where they need to be attending.
Okay, and then presumably with this, are they better at multitasking?
I think that's probably true as well. We have little bits of evidence that if you give them two things to do at the same time, bilinguals can integrate both tasks more efficiently than monolinguals.
And you talk about this in relation to executive control. Just for the uninitiated, what is that and what advantages do the bilinguals have with that?
Everything that we do, from simple tasks like driving to social interactions to problem solving, everything we do requires that we constantly make selections. We need to attend to some of the information in our environment because it's high value and relevant for our problem solving, and ignore other things that are less relevant. So if you're driving down the highway, you want to pay attention to the traffic, to the exit signs. You want to not be distracted by the advertisements. So everything we do is like that. And the way our brain is set up is that there is a part of our brain right in the very front, in the frontal lobes, that is designed precisely to pay attention when there's competing sources of information. It's a part of the brain that is the very last to develop in maturity, and by some estimates isn't fully mature until around 20 years old, and sadly is the first to decline with normal healthy aging. So this ability to pay attention selectively is a very effortful process. It requires a lot of brain energy, and we have it for the shortest amount of time. That is the executive function or the executive control system.
Okay, you made a connection there between aging and the efficiency of this part of your brain. If you're a bilingual, to what degree will that be affected? For example, are bilinguals less prone to dementia, or do they live longer?
There's no evidence that they live longer. There's no evidence that they're less prone to dementia, but there's very substantial evidence that they show symptoms of dementia later.
Right.
Now, this is a tricky argument. So on average, and there are about a dozen studies from different countries around the world that have shown this, on average, bilinguals show symptoms of dementia 4 or 5 years later than monolinguals. But when you look into their brains, at the point where bilinguals show these symptoms, they start behaving in ways that we would describe as demented. The dementia in their brain is more advanced. So in the earlier stages of dementia, as the neuropathology is accumulating in their brains, bilinguals continue to function as though nothing is wrong.
How
This
interesting.
is important because dementia is a disease of aging. So postponing it is huge, and there are no cures. The drug therapies are very limited in their effectiveness. So postponing the symptoms in that creating a healthy brain that's able to continue functioning even while early stages of dementia pathology are forming, this is about as much as we've got now in the fight against dementia.
Wow. Doesn't your research also suggest that there's an exception with Parkinson's disease, and that actually validates this whole thing about executive function to an extent?
Yes, Parkinson's disease is characterized by deficits in the executive function system. So Parkinsonian patients typically have poor executive function. So if executive function is the source of the protection for bilinguals, and you knock out that system, you've knocked out the protection.
Yep, that makes a lot of sense. Okay, like, can we move on now to another topic? So what effect does social economic status have on a bilingualism or bilingual children?
It's an important question because for a long time there were challenges to our research with children in that there was some concern that maybe we weren't measuring bilingualism, but instead perhaps all of the children who ended up in our bilingual sample were more socioeconomically advantaged. So it was a very important challenge and it needed to be addressed. And there's now about a half a dozen studies that have done this in very careful ways, and again, replicated by different groups. So the main way of doing it is you take four groups instead of two groups. You take middle-class children who are equated on their socioeconomic status, who are monolingual or bilingual, and you take a lower stratum. In one study, it was what I call working-class children. They're not poor children. They have less educated parents. Another study done in Chicago used poorer children. It doesn't matter. Those children are also divided into monolinguals and bilinguals. So now you can compare, because you have a full design, how much does monolingual versus bilingual affect performance on these executive function tasks? And how much does being middle class versus lower class affect performance on these tasks? And the answer is both factors do that. So being bilingual is better than being monolingual for performance, and being middle class is better than being poor for performance. But bilingualism is always a factor. So we have indeed been able to show that socioeconomic status is very important in children's development, but so is bilingualism.
Okay, interesting. Just in relation to that, Ellen, I've just come back from a holiday in the Basque Country in Spain, where I used to live, and there's a very well established bilingual program there with Basque. And a Basque friend of mine, who's a teacher, told me last week that she had some concerns with the program. I was actually talking to her in relation to our interview, especially with regard to immigrant children. For example, when a family coming from, say, Bolivia comes to Spain, they often don't see any particular advantage in learning Basque. So often the motivation is not there to support their children sufficiently. How crucial is this kind of sort of intrinsic motivation?
I think this is very crucial. And this goes back to research that was done in the 1960s. A lot of it from a group in Montreal, although there were other groups studying this. So what predicts or what enables somebody to learn a second language? You already know one language. What will determine the success you have in learning another language? And all of these social factors are really important. Your attitude toward the language, your motivation for learning the language, the status of the language. If you perceive it to be a low status language, you're going to have a lot of trouble learning it. Your attitudes towards the group who speak the language. These social factors are huge in determining how successful you'll be in learning another language.
Okay. If you stop using the two languages, do you lose the benefits?
It's a question that we've wondered about. So we had one study on the topic, the only study I know on this question. And so I'll just tell you about this one study. We were wondering too, what about people who used to be bilingual? Has their brain and cognitive system maintained some of the rewiring that we saw for bilingualism? So our explanation for the bilingual effects is that they come from practice, that the practice, the experience of using two languages, and I can explain more precisely what it is about that experience, enhances these selective attention systems. So if it's an effect based on experience or practice, then you should assume the more you practice, the better you'll be. If you are a pianist and you want to play a Beethoven piano sonata, you've got to practice it. And if you practice it every day, you'll play it.
Yeah.
If you come back 10 years later and haven't practiced it, you'll play it less well. So we wanted to know if that model applies to bilingualism. So we did a study where we had three groups of participants. They were all young adults, they were all about 20 to 22 years old. One group was monolingual. A second group was French-English bilingual, fully bilingual. They used both languages all the time. And a lot of them had their introduction to French when they entered school. When they were 5 years old, they went into French immersion programs, like the Basque program you described. And they learned French in school, but they kept it up. They were now studying in French, so they were French-English bilingual. The third group entered those same French immersion programs when they were 5 years old, but left the program when they were 11. So they have not used French for half their lives.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Those are the three groups. We gave them all our executive control standard tasks. The bilinguals, fully French-English bilinguals, outperformed the monolinguals just as we would expect. That group that we called the lapsed bilinguals, those people who used to be bilingual, were right in the middle. And they weren't different from monolinguals, and they weren't different from bilinguals. They were right in the middle. So our interpretation is there was something residual going on. Maybe if we came back in another 10 years, they would then look just like monolinguals. But at this point in time, they were halfway between.
That's very encouraging in a sense. If you know, if you've lived in a country and you do start to lose a language, you know, it's the recognition you've not lost all of it then and all the benefits. Okay. In Welsh, the word for school, ysgol, also means ladder. So if you can speak both Welsh and English, you arguably have a richer concept of school as a place to move up in the world. In this regard, would you say that bilinguals are less confined by language as they understand in a very embodied way how flexible it is?
I think that's a really good example of what I described earlier as metalinguistic awareness. And this is what we learned in the 70s. Bilinguals have better metalinguistic awareness. They have a better understanding, not only of the structure of language, but of how language carries meanings, how words refer. Bilinguals know that they can say things in different ways, that they have at least two different words for dog, for cat, and so on. So it broadens their perspective of what meaning is and how words convey meanings. So I think you're right. I think that that's one of the enlarging insights that you get from knowing more than one language.
And then do you think it gives you not just meaning, but also, well, it's connected, but a greater understanding of culture? I spent many years abroad, and through that period I've learned a couple of languages, and often learning languages, another language, seems a key to actually understanding in many ways the culture of another language, as well as giving the opportunity to see your own language from another lens.
I think they're both true. I'll give you an example of the first point, though, about the connection between language and culture. Languages are deeply embedded in the culture. And so an anecdote I'll tell you is that a friend of mine who is a Japanese-English bilingual, fully fluent in both languages, knows that there's certain conversations she can only have in one of those languages. For example, if the conversation with her Japanese friend is going to require some argument, some kind of assertiveness, she can't do that in Japanese. That conversation has to take place in English. So the cultural material around the languages also determine how you can use those languages. And if you really understand the language and the culture, you can move between them. So she shifts to English if she knows she's going to have to be assertive.
Yeah, well, a similar example of that is with Basque, because Basque doesn't really have any swear words. So so if you stub your toe, most Basque speakers then revert to Spanish. Anyway, perhaps related to this as well, one of the recent findings coming out of psychology and neuroscience is that a tolerance of ambiguity can help us make less biased decisions. Is there any evidence that bilingualism can make us more open-minded in this way?
There is possibly some small indirect evidence. It's hard to say with any assertiveness, any decisiveness, that bilingualism affects something that really comes close to being what I would call a personality trait. So let me start by qualifying everything I'm going to say with the notion that tolerance of ambiguity is recognized individual difference in personality. And as with any human trait, people will distribute normally on that curve. And bilinguals and monolinguals will also distribute normally on that curve. So you'll have monolinguals and bilinguals all over the curve. I think it's important to keep that in mind. Now, having said that, there are very small and more precise pieces of evidence that on tasks where you have to hold an ambiguous idea in mind, bilinguals may be better at this. The example that we've used in our research is that we show monolingual and bilingual participants these standard ambiguous figures that are used in psychology. So these will be figures like an image that could be a duck or it could be a rabbit. It could be a vase or it could be a profile of two faces. These images are in all intro psych textbooks. So we show these images to monolinguals and bilinguals, and we say, what do you see? And they'll say, I see a duck. Okay. And then we explain the image actually has another interpretation. And we have many of these images, not just the ones in psych textbooks. This image has another interpretation. Do you see anything else? Well, no, I don't. So you guide them through the process by pointing out the key features and measure the point at which they can see the other image. We've done this with children and young adults, and in both cases, bilinguals see the other image earlier. So there's something about giving up on what they've decided it is. I know I said it was a duck, but I'm okay to back off and be open to the possibility that it's something else. It's a rabbit. Bilinguals do that earlier, easier.
Okay. The middle way, as we understand it, is, and this might be related to what you've just been saying, is the idea that we make better judgments by avoiding fixed or dogmatic beliefs about things. That then throws us back on experience, so we're left in the messy, uncertain middle. But it's arguably in the messy, uncertain middle that we can actually start to get to grips more adequately with the phenomena that we encounter, whatever they are. Now, how might that relate to what we've been talking about today?
I think that's actually a very nice model for bilingualism. What bilingualism does, what mastering another language, forcing yourself to understand another culture, what it does is challenge all of your assumptions. So, you know, kids grow up, monolingual kids grow up at least, thinking, I can speak. I speak English because that's what language is, or I speak French because that's what language is. But really coming to terms with the notion that that's only one of many different ways of communicating, one of many different cultures in which we find ourselves, I think that challenge of seeing your language as one among many has to be intellectually enlarging. In terms of making good decisions in this mushy middle that you're describing, the one thing that gets us through that more than anything else, I believe, is information.
Yeah.
More knowledge of what the alternatives are, what the range of views are, what the options are. And I see knowledge of multiple languages as being presented with a constant range of alternatives that forces you to see choices and see your view, your language, your culture as only one option. So in the end, I think that could only be a good thing.
Okay, and in this regard, what advice then would you give to parents, either from two linguistic backgrounds or parents who want to encourage their children to learn another language?
Okay, well, it's not a simple question, and it's one that comes up a lot. So I think we have to separate this into two parts. The first is a situation where parents know another language, know a language other than the one spoken in the community in which they happen to live. So French expats living in London, for example, who speak French at home, for example, that
yeah.
kind of thing. Have a child. What do they speak to the child? Well, the problem here, and the answer is simple, but the problem is there is a huge pressure, and has been for decades, for parents to assimilate their children into the majority language of their culture as quickly as possible. Terrifying stories about mental retardation, confusion, failure to learn language have been circulating for decades,
yeah.
and they are false. But it's enough to frighten parents into thinking that we better just speak English because we're living in London. There is no evidence that that's the case. So in a situation where parents know another language other than the one spoken in the community, I think parents have an obligation to speak that language to their children, not only because it will make the child bilingual and this child will grow up speaking French. I think more importantly, because it will connect that child to their heritage, to their grandparents,
yeah.
to their culture. You can't cut children off in this way. Now, having said that, to this day, physicians, clinicians, speech language pathologists routinely continue to to advise parents not to confuse their children and only speak English. This is wrong advice. Now, the second situation that you raise is you have monolingual English-speaking parents in London, and they have a child, but they would like their child to be bilingual. What should they do? And I get emails from people who have all sorts of plans. We're going to hire a French nanny. We're going to play, audio tapes in Spanish, all these plans. Here I would say, don't panic, because the main importance of language in the home is for communication, not for language classes. So when children are very young, I think you want to do whatever is most natural to communicate. At some point, parents have to decide at what point, you can begin exposing children to other languages through a preschool program, through an early immersion program, and so on. The fact that is not well known is that older children are actually better language learners than younger children. There's lots of time. So give them opportunities, give them possibilities for exposure, but don't panic. Just make the environment as language rich as possible.
Okay, brilliant. Okay, well, thank you very much for talking to me today, Ellen. It's been absolutely fascinating and a real pleasure.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.